Hello, it's so good to be here to take back the radio. My name is Audrey Wandolo. I'm part of the Amandla crew on Saturday Morning Live.
And I am Amandla from the same group.
So it's sort of interesting being here, first of all, and the fact that I go to Ryerson University and I'm a Ryerson student and I pay my fees, but we can't be on the radio. But it's our radio. So I'm happy that we're having this forum to talk about taking back our radio, because guess what? I'm paying for some of those fees. So I'm glad we're having this conversation. We're going to have a couple of stuff for you. We're trying to have a conversation with some people in South Africa, but unfortunately it's like 2 o'clock in the morning there, but they're going to be listening and we're going to be sending them the information. Anybody who's been to the continent knows how important radio is, knows how important having a voice is, because not everybody has access to TVs, not everybody has access to, you know, some of the technologies we have here. So radio has really been used as a forum for women, for young people. And I'm so glad that we have the opportunity here as women, as young people, to come and speak about the important topics that we speak to.
So we're going to have two pieces today. The first part will be Saturday Morning Live with the Horn Report, the General Horn Report. And it's going to be an interview that we tape already. We're going to play for about 10, 15 minutes. Yeah. And after that, we're going to have a second interview regarding a person that have impacted consciences in Africa for the work he have done in terms of trying to elevate the condition of women in Africa. And the name is Thomas Sankara. He played a very great role in Africa from 1983 to 1987. Unfortunately, his experience was stopped and he was killed in 1987. And we're going to have an interview with Karina Ray, who is a professor in New York, who will be talking about Thomas Sankara and also of one of the person who is suspected of having played a role in the assassination of Thomas Sankara, who is now standing trial in The Hague, who is called Charles Taylor, who used to be the president of Liberia and who have destabilized the whole West African region for a couple of years, and who seem to have been involved in the assassination of Sankara. So this is going to be the two interviews we're going to have for you today.
Okay, so let's start off with Gerald Horn.
Welcome to CKLM's International Women's Day broadcast in exile. My name is Omesa Malachemtula, and we'll be hosting the Saturday Morning Live segment. And joining us on the line is Dr. Gerald Horn, who is not someone new to our listening audience and is a regular contributor to Saturday Morning Live. And we're really happy to have him here with us today, contributing to our direct action. Hello, Dr. Horn.
Well, hello, and how are you?
I'm good. And yourself?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, so we want to start off by talking about something that you're always talking about, the state of the economy, but we wanted to especially focus on how this current recession is disproportionately affecting women. All the CEOs we know that are getting bonuses out of this recession are men, but in a more kind of analytical way, women are being disproportionately affected.
You're absolutely correct, and it's also a paradoxical impact. First of all, the capitalist economy, as Warren Buffett, the billionaire investor, has put it, has fallen off the cliff. I think the World Bank just the other day suggested that perhaps $50 trillion in value and in wealth had been wiped out, eradicated, just within recent months. So clearly this is probably the most severe economic downturn of the capitalist world since the 1930s. Now here comes the paradox. Part of the paradox is that manufacturing, particularly in the North Atlantic countries, is taking a real hit. If you look at the auto plants in Ontario, for example, which are really on the ropes, having to go to Ottawa with their begging bowls seeking subsidies, these auto plants disproportionately employ men. At the same time, if you look at certain industries like healthcare and education, which significantly employ women, they're, in a sense, doing better than the manufacturing sector. But if you turn your spotlight to the developing world, if you turn your spotlight to Africa and Asia and Latin America in particular, what you'll find is that women in particular are really being devastated by this global economic downturn. They're being devastated in a number of ways. First of all, because the United States is in such a severe economic crisis, it is attracting capital. It's borrowing capital from all over the world. And that is crowding out the possibility of governments in Africa, for example, being able to attract that very same capital. So therefore, even in Africa's most developed country, that is to say South Africa, you've seen a very severe shrinkage in the gross domestic product over the past few months. And so this crisis, in the first place, I think it's fair to say, has been devastating for women in the developing countries.
And we also wanted to talk about a few events that have, or a few newsworthy pieces that have happened out of the African continent. First, Suzanne Tsvangirai, who is Prime Minister of Zimbabwe Tsvangirai's wife, has died in a car crash, and Tsvangirai himself was injured in that crash. Could you talk a bit about that? And what, if any, impact that will have on the current political situation in Zimbabwe?
Well, I must say, when I first got the news, I was startled and shocked, as so many were, because being a longtime student of Zimbabwe politics, I know that oftentimes political opponents have been eliminated through auto crashes. It's almost a running joke, I'm afraid, a sardonic joke at that, in Zimbabwe. But once you start to drill down and get to the details, I think it's understandable why Prime Minister Tsvangirai basically said that this was a one-in-a-thousand accident. I mean, first of all, the driver of the truck that hit the Toyota Land Cruiser that was conveying Prime Minister Tsvangirai and his wife was being driven by a contractor of the U.S. government, of the U.S. Agency for International Development. So it's very difficult to imagine that the United States was conspiring with the ruling party in Zimbabwe to eliminate the prime minister. That basically makes no sense. And I think that that particular detail has tended to calm the waters, as well as the fact that the president, Robert Mugabe, visited Mr. Tsvangirai in the hospital, that other leading officials of the ruling party visited Mr. Tsvangirai in the hospital. And after a brief visit to Botswana, the neighboring country, for medical care, it seems that Mr. Tsvangirai is back on the job, and hopefully the situation in Zimbabwe will be calmed to the extent that it won't lead to a further crisis, the fact that this unfortunate tragedy has just occurred.
And moving to the Sudan, the International Criminal Courts issued a warrant for the arrest of Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. He is refusing to comply. There's been a lot of voices coming out of the Sudan that are saying, you know, this is not the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Courts. Bashir doesn't recognize the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Courts. Can you comment on that?
Well, this is a very touchy and sensitive situation, and I think that people in North America in particular need to pay close attention, because the Sudanese question basically exposes a developing rift between Africa on the one hand and the North Atlantic powers on the other. The African nations, and more specifically the African Union, is very concerned that the International Criminal Court seems to have a penchant, a proclivity for indicting African leaders, which would be okay and understandable if They, for example, looked at what Israel was doing in Gaza in December, January of in recent months, December 2008, January 2009, and the devastation that was inflicted on this colonized territory. Or if they were to look at what the NATO powers are doing in Afghanistan, the heavy toll that has been taken on civilian life, or what the U.S. and its so-called Coalition of the Willing did in Iraq in terms of the thousands, tens of thousands of Iraqis that have died there. But the International Criminal Court does not seem to look at that direction. Instead, it seems to be on this kick of indicting African leaders, or, for example, European leaders who formerly headed socialist countries, such as Milosevic of the former Yugoslavia. And many African nations are beginning to wonder if the International Criminal Court is turning into some sort of neo-colonial enterprise with a more respectable name. Obviously, this is unacceptable. George W. Bush, I understand, was just in Calgary, Canada, picking up a handsome check for a speaking fee. There was no attempt, as I understand it, by the Canadian authorities to arrest him, to detain him for war crimes, including torture, including the illegal facility in Guantanamo, Cuba. And so there is a persistent and nagging concern that the International Criminal Court is basically a tool of hypocrisy. Now, this is not in any way to downgrade or denigrate the unfolding tragedy that's taking place in Western Sudan in Darfur. Certainly, there is a credibility and substance to many of the points that are raised in the indictment. But even if one grants that, I think it's fair to say that it probably would have been more effective if the ICC had tried to indict Mr. al-Bashir after he had left office. Because what you see now is that the government led by Mr. al-Bashir has basically expelled many aid groups, and this is going to lead to a humanitarian catastrophe unfolding as we speak. And so one has to wonder, in light of the fact that Mr. al-Bashir does not seem to be headed to The Hague, and in light of this unfolding humanitarian tragedy in Western Sudan that's unfolding as we speak, whether or not this indictment was really worth it at this precise and particular moment.
And you mentioned Israel-Palestine briefly, so I wanted to ask you that. Today in Cairo, the two Palestinian parties are meeting, that would be Hamas and Fatah, to try to work out some sort of unity talks. So what are your comments on that?
Well, let us hope, and as they say, let us pray that those unity talks basically work out, because quite frankly, I think that many of Israel's staunchest supporters are beginning to realize slowly but surely that the Israeli authorities, despite their rhetoric to the contrary, have no interest in seeing an independent Palestinian state. And certainly the possibility of an independent Palestinian state is flummoxed by the fact that there is Palestinian disunity. You might recall what happened a few years ago when there was actual shooting between Fatah and Hamas. And of course, in many ways, Hamas emerged triumphant. This was a tragedy. And I hope that they are able to broker a deal. I hope that they're able to reach a reasonable and mutually satisfactory settlement, because that would be a concrete step towards international peace and security, insofar as that would be a concrete step towards that long-awaited Palestinian state.
NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is looking for a new Secretary General, and in the running is Canada's Defense Minister, Peter MacKay. We've talked about him several times on these airwaves. What would it mean for NATO to, for the first time, have a General Secretary that is not from Europe?
Well, quite frankly, I think it would be a setback for the Canadian peace movement, because in some precincts in Canada, this might mean that the peace-loving Canadian people might be more predisposed to support this warmongering organization, which, as we speak, is inflicting untold murder and tragedy upon the people of Afghanistan. Quite frankly, NATO, which is marking its 60th anniversary this year, is an organization in search of a mission. Keep in mind that it was called into being, supposedly, to confront the so-called Soviet threat, but the Soviet Union has been out of existence almost two decades, but NATO still putters along. Obviously, NATO is an imperialist tool meant to subjugate peoples and nations across the world. And I think it would be a step backward if a Canadian, quite frankly, were to take the helm. I think that a more satisfactory outcome would be for a Canadian to take the helm and then try to preside over the liquidation of NATO.
Do you think if Peter McKay takes over, he'll try to do that?
Surely you're joking.
Of course I am, of course. In more Canadian news, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the CBC, is asking the government for more funding. They currently get $1.1 billion, saying that in these hard times, their advertising has gone down, and they're asking the government for more money. But the Heritage Minister, James Moore, says the government has no intention of giving the CBC more money. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have mixed feelings, very, very, very mixed feelings, because as a person who lives south of the Canadian border, I do pay attention to CBC, and even though this oftentimes gets me into hot water with my Canadian friends, CBC does a better job than its U.S. counterparts, quite frankly. At the same time, of course, if I were living north of the border, I would be highly critical of CBC because the political space in Canada is much more open than in the United States, and it's possible for the CBC to be more progressive than it is. And so I have mixed feelings with regard to what you've just said. I'm not sure how to react. How do you react to it?
I think if we could move some more money away from, you know, our occupation in Afghanistan and maybe move it to the CBC, I'd be very happy. But I think what would be more encouraging is to support community radio, such as ourselves. That would be a more encouraging move. But then I would not like to see the CBC, on the other hand, for example, CBC Radio, need to turn to advertising on radio in order to make ends meet. That would not be a good option, I think, in my mind.
Oh, that would be brain-deadening. I hope and trust that that is not the direction they plan to turn.
I hope not. Well, turning over to probably our last story, Bill Clinton and Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the UN and former U.S. President, visited Haiti yesterday in an effort to increase development aid to that part of the world and quell, I guess, continuing fighting in Haiti. Can you comment on that?
Well, certainly Haiti has been undergoing problems of biblical proportion and magnitude, particularly in the last 5 years since the ouster of the democratically elected leader, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was driven into exile in South Africa by the U.S. authorities and their henchmen. I think that particular move basically illustrated what some of us already know, which is that it's rarely wise to remove from office a democratically elected leader. Not only that, but the hurricanes that have inflicted the Western Hemisphere in recent months and years have had a particularly devastating impact upon Haiti. And as a result, you see Haitians beginning to immigrate, of course, to South Florida, to Canada, to the Dominican Republic, to Jamaica, and elsewhere. And this is a very sad turn of affairs in light of the fact that, as we well know, Haiti historically has played a torch-bearing role in terms of fighting for freedom, going back to the Haitian Revolution some 200 years ago. So if the intentions of Mr. Clinton and Mr. Ban Ki-moon are in the direction of the comments that I've just enunciated, that is to say, pointing towards independent and progressive development for Haiti, then I support their trip. But if it's basically intended to tighten the neocolonial manacles on Haiti's wrist, then obviously that particular trip needs to be rebuffed.
I am speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, who is a regular contributor to Saturday Morning Live and who is joining us today for our International Women's Day CKLN broadcast in exile. Dr. Horn, I'd like to really thank you for joining us and being part of this exciting event.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to Saturday Morning Live, and this is Take Back Our Radio, which is a collective effort to gain back the radio wave on CKLN 88.1 FM here in Toronto. The next segment of this show is called Amanla, brought to you by GRILA, the Group for Research and Initiatives for the Liberation of Africa. And the interview we have is with Cardinal Ray regarding the trial of Charles Taylor, the former president of Liberia, who've been accused of being part of the plot that assassinated the late president of Burkina Faso, Thomas Sankara, in 1987. Cardinal Ray has been interviewed with by Ome Salma.
I'm joined on the line today with Karina Ray, who is an assistant professor of history at Fordham University in New York City, where she teaches African and Black Atlantic history. She is also a monthly columnist for New African magazine. In January of this year, Karina wrote a feature article in the Pembazooka News, where she looked at the possibility that Charles Taylor was complicit in the assassination of Thomas Sankara. Hello, Karina. So I wanted to start off by asking you to recap for our listeners what is Charles Taylor being accused of that makes him stand trial in The Hague. And he's actually, and if you could also get into the fact that he's actually standing trial in the special courts for Sierra Leone, but it's taking place in The Hague. So what is the impetus for these trials and why it's taking place in The Hague?
Okay, sure. His trial is taking place physically in The Hague, but he's being tried by the Special Court for Sierra Leone, and that was a decision taken because they were worried about the implications of him actually being physically tried in Sierra Leone, like, you know, that could cause too much destabilization within the region. Obviously, he still has a lot of supporters in the region, and obviously has a lot of people that oppose him. So they were just worried that it would be cause too much tension in the region. So they had the special court relocated to The Hague, but they maintain control over the trial. So he's being tried for 11 charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity, and I can just quickly go over what those 11 charges are. The first one is acts of terrorism, which is considered a war crime. The second one is falls under the heading of unlawful killings, and so he has a charge of murder, which is crimes against humanity. And under that heading of unlawful killings, he also has a war crimes charge of violence to life, health, and physical or mental well-being of persons, and in particular, murder. Under the heading of sexual violence, he is standing a charge of rape, which is a crime against humanity. Sexual slavery and other forms of sexual violence, again, considered a crime against humanity. And outrages upon personal dignity, which is considered a war crime. The seventh charge that he faces, which comes under the heading of physical violence, is also a war crime, and that's violence to life, health, and physical or mental well-being of persons, in particular cruel treatment. And then also under physical violence, he's facing an eighth charge of other inhumane acts, so sort of a more general thing to include various different things that he's either done himself or sponsored under his rule. That's considered a crime against humanity. The next heading is use of child soldiers. That's his ninth charge, which is conscripting or enlisting children under the age of 15 into the armed forces or groups and using them to participate actively in hostilities. And this comes under a heading which is called other serious violations of international humanitarian law. The tenth charge that he faces is enslavement, and that's a crime against humanity. And the final charge that he faced comes under the heading looting, and that's a war crime of the specific charges, pillage. So in the context of war itself, pillaging areas in which the war was actually taking place. So a lot of these charges are not necessarily charges that say he specifically did X, Y, and Z, but that under his leadership, under his command, these acts were carried out. So there's two sets of charges. Ones that he may have been personally responsible for, and others that he gave the direction for.
And the trial started in January of this year. Is that correct?
Well, it restarted.
Okay.
It was delayed. It was moved, and then it was delayed. He had his defense team was reorganized, so it was really delayed, and then restarted in January of 2008 once his new defense team was constituted. And prior to that, I mean, they had, you know, the team that he had had been very skillful in just postponing the trial as long as possible. But now it is, it's in full bloom now.
And before we get to talking to the implications or what has come out of the trial, especially as it relates to Thomas Sankara, I wanted to step back a bit. And if you could tell us a bit about Charles Taylor's history, specifically his arrests and detention in the United States prior to his rearrival, I guess, in West Africa.
Sure. One thing that's really important to note is that he, thus far, the idea that he could have had something to do with Thomas Sankara's assassination, he has not been formally charged with that at all. And that was part of what prompted me to write this article for Pam Bazooka, Who Really Killed Thomas Sankara, because I find it interesting that so many people have, along the way, mentioned this connection of a Charles Taylor, involvement in Sankara's assassination, but that he has never been, it's never been something that's been formally investigated. And it has already come up as a topic in the special court proceedings in 2004, and I can get to that a bit later. So it's already been something that's been mentioned, but it's never been a specific targeted investigation vis-a-vis Charles Taylor. And so I thought, really, with the timing now of the trial happening, and also the fact that, in 2006, the United Nations Human Rights Committee, ruled that Sankara's family has the right to know under the circumstances which he was murdered, I felt like this was an important time to raise that question. So just to be clear, that he's actually not facing a charge related to Sankara's assassination, although I would, like for it to be I'm calling it for it to be investigated and to see if that's something that, at some point he should also face trial for. Obviously, the investigation has to come before any sort of charge. I'm just saying I think it warrants real attention. So having said that, essentially what happened was that Charles Taylor had been jailed in Massachusetts pending extradition to Liberia on embezzlement charges that were levied against him by the Doe regime. Okay, so he's in Massachusetts, and he's arrested there, and he's pending extradition. At that time, he breaks out of this prison in Massachusetts. Evidently, his wife at the time, his sister-in-law, were, helped him break out of the jail. He broke out with four other people. Those four other people were eventually captured and arrested, as were his wife at the time and his sister-in-law. But Charles Taylor was the one person in that group that succeeded in not being captured, and made his way in 1985 he made his way to Ghana. And essentially there are, a couple of different versions of what happens once he reaches Ghana, but what we do know is that he's jailed in Ghana twice while there for sort of kind of getting involved in riling things up on the local scene there. There was a Liberian expatriate community there, and so he was at two points he was jailed there in Ghana. In 1987, and this is according to S. Byron Tarr, who is a Liberian economist and who actually published an article in 1993 in a very respected academic journal called Issue, a Journal of African Opinion, And he was actually writing on ECOMOG, but in and specifically ECOMOG's intervention in the Liberian Civil War between 1989 and 1996. And so in that piece, he actually sort of gives a very detailed account of what he thinks happened with Taylor. And essentially, the outline of it is that, you know, he's there in Accra, and he ends up approaching the Burkinabe embassy to ask for assistance in overthrowing the Doe regime in Liberia. Okay, and obviously he had already had this antagonistic relationship with the Doe regime, who was trying to imprison him for embezzlement, etc. So the Burkinabe ambassador to Ghana at that time, who was Madame Mamuna Wadera, who was also supposed to be tied to Blaise Compaoré, according to Byron Tarr, she solicits Compaoré's assistance in getting the Ghanaian authorities to release Taylor to Burkinabe custody. And evidently this was facilitated by the fact that Ghana, under J.J. Rawlings, didn't want to hand Taylor back to the Americans and also didn't want to hand him over to the Doe regime. So apparently Rawlings released him to Compaoré, who had come to Accra as part of a mediation process that Rawlings was undertaking at the time to resolve the mounting disagreements between Thomas Sankara and Blaise Compaoré. So at that time, obviously, Sankara was leading the revolutionary government in Burkina Faso. Compaoré had historically been his right-hand person and very close friend, but after the August Revolution, there was growing tension between these two men. So it's important to note that Compaoré's taking possession of or being handed, the Ghanaians handing Taylor over to Compaoré at that time coincides with this point when Compaoré and Sankara's relationship has become increasingly antagonistic, and Rawlings, who was very close to Sankara, was trying to mediate this. So again, this is all according to Byron Tarr's version of events, which are more or less supported by other people's versions. So what ends up happening is that not long after Taylor was handed over to Compaoré, Sankara was murdered. And in exchange for Taylor's assistance in carrying out Sankara's assassination, Tarr suggests that Compaoré provided assistance to Taylor, who was obviously in the process of organizing the guerrilla war that would eventually lead to the overthrow of the Doe regime. So there was a trade-off, essentially.
And what has come out in the trial of Charles Taylor in The Hague that specifically alludes to this? Has Charles Taylor revealed anything? Has there been evidence brought forward in the courts, the special courts for Sierra Leone, that solidified this version of the story?
Well, in 2004, a similar version of events was also given by Brigadier General John Tarnu, who was a former commander general of the Armed Forces of Liberia, who testified in front of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. Okay, so again, prior to this trial being moved to The Hague, that he had heard Taylor admit to participating in Sankara's assassination at the request of Blaise Compaoré. So John Tarnu's testimony in 2004 supports this version of events. But as far as the trial in The Hague is concerned, again, this has not come up as a specific topic for investigation because nobody has ever formally charged or investigated Taylor for any involvement in Sankara's assassination. So again, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying this is something that needs to be investigated to see whether or not a charge is warranted. I've just been struck by the fact that I have seen in so many different venues, so everything from a respected academic journal to, multiple articles on the perspective.org, which is an extremely active Liberian online magazine, to other websites that have all sort of been mentioning this involvement, but there's never been, you know, a kind of formal investigation into it. And even with, in 2004, when John Tarnu is giving this account of him overhearing, or not overhearing, I mean, he was being addressed formally by Taylor, and Taylor was explaining his role in the Sankara assassination. That came up in, you know, in a much larger sort of questioning about Tarnu's involvement with Taylor. So it comes up as a side point rather than a focal point. And I'm saying let's make this a focal point to see whether or not, you know, there's something there, and whether or not he, in addition to all of the other things that he's being tried for, whether or not he should also be tried for a role that he may have played in the assassination of Thomas Sankara. And of course, we all know that you know, justice has never been served. I mean, obviously, it's widely accepted that Blaise Compaoré ordered his assassination. You know, that's, I mean, Blaise Compaoré is the sitting president and has been since Sankara was assassinated, and that's not, you know, that quest for justice has never been achieved.
And so I want to ask you this, and this might lead to another question, but in what forum, then, does this investigation need to come about? I can see it coming about as part of the Hague trials and the special courts for Sierra Leone, but also as part of the decision recently made by the UN Commission on Human Rights that the family of Thomas Sankara has the right to know how he was assassinated.
Right.
And so I can see it coming out in these two forums.
It would definitely have to come out in the second forum, because the special court for Sierra Leone is only concerned with war crimes and crimes against humanity as they relate to Sierra Leone. Its jurisdiction is really limited to that. So it really it can't really take place in that venue. And this is also, if you read a lot of commentary by Liberians, this is one of the things that many Liberians, are aggrieved at, right, which is that obviously, you know, Liberians suffered immensely under Charles Taylor, but he's being tried for crimes committed against Sierra Leoneans in the context of the RUF in Sierra Leone, et cetera. So, you know, there are a lot of people that feel like Charles Taylor should be, tried for a multiplicity of different crimes. But right now at The Hague, those crimes are going to be specific to Sierra Leone. So he would have to be tried, or an investigation would have to take place really under the auspices of, this recent ruling by the United Nations Human Rights Committee. I just think this is the time when we, you know, when the international spotlight is already on Charles Taylor. I think we need to, you know, use that attention and really focus it to ask, you know, what are other areas in which he ought to be brought to justice, not necessarily specifically at the special court for Sierra Leone, but in a different venue if necessary.
And maybe moving more towards discussing the United Nations Commission on Human Rights and the decision that came down recently, do you think this increasing awareness or this increasing normality that Charles Taylor was involved in the assassination can give or will be giving more validity to what the UN Human Rights Commission is demanding in terms of an investigation of the death of Sankara?
Wait, so, sorry, can you just repeat that again?
Sure, I just wanted to know, in terms of, you know, Charles Taylor being tried, it being coming out more in public forums that he had had something to do with the assassination, is that going to give more impetus and more of a push for what the UN Commission on Human Rights is asking for, basically for the family of Sankara to know how he died?
Well, that's what I'm hoping for, but I feel very much that unless people make it an explicit point, it won't happen. I feel like there's a couple of things going on. One is that Sankara was assassinated now 20 years ago. You know, Blaise Compaoré has more or less been accepted, you know, by the international community. You know, people don't make it a point to sort of remind him of how he got into power, nor to delegitimize his authority, you know, by bringing up Sankara's assassination. So there's been kind of a normalization of Burkina Faso's status and of Compaoré's authority, which make it, you know, which make the Sankara assassination not something that I think the international community has really pursued. And of course, part of that comes from the fact that at this, you know, I'm sure if there was some currency to be gained, something to be gained by bringing this charge, by really sort of looking at it, you know, in the context of Compaoré and you know, of Sankara, it would have happened. But I think that at least with regards to Compaoré, nobody really wants to stir that pot, right? He's kind of towing, you know, Compaoré is sort of towing the line in Burkina Faso. He's not, you know, he's not threatening anybody's agenda, not least, you know, in the international community. So I think there's very little impetus to push that. And it's unfortunate, right? I mean, it tends to be that, you know, people are really only brought to justice by the West when the West's own interests are at hand. And, of course, you know, you will hear that a lot with regards to Charles Taylor, you know, that he's being tried because, you know, not because of all of the crimes against humanity and war crimes that he committed, but because, you know, it has served the West's interest to get him out of power because he was no longer towing the line there, and he really became a political liability, right? I think we need to have a viewpoint which allows room for understanding both, mm-hmm. right? That, you know, clearly he did commit crimes against humanity and extensive war crimes. There's no way anybody can look, you know, at Sierra Leone and look at the thousands of, you know, limbless people and not say that the RUF was not responsible for horrific crimes against humanity and war crimes. And we all know that Charles Taylor was funding the RUF and was in addition to Fode Sanko was directing it. So, you know, those things are clear, and obviously that's what this trial is about. But obviously, you know, it was politically expedient and important for him to face trial on these charges. Not so much, I would say, with somebody like Blaise Compaoré, who's managed to stay out of the international limelight when it comes to things like that. So I think, you know, I think in short what I'm trying to say is that we as a community of people who are committed to ensuring that Thomas Sankara's memory, number one, is kept alive, and number two, that those who, you know, who assassinated him are brought to justice, I think it's really up to us to continue calling for, you know, an investigation of the multiple scenarios by which he could have been assassinated. And I think the United Nations Human Rights Committee 2006 ruling is a very big step in that direction. But unless we, you know, continue to call for it, I just think there's a kind of, you know, inertia that will stall. You know, I think we have to continue to be very, very forceful, because I think this is not necessarily an issue that, you know, other people feel as passionately about.
Thank you very much, Karina, for that. That brings us to the end of the time that we have, but I think that's a great place to maybe stop. But I wanted to, before we leave, for you to give out the website information where people can find out and follow the trial.
Yes, absolutely. So there's a website, and it is CharlesTaylorTrial.org. So very simple, CharlesTaylorTrial.org. This website literally on a daily basis uploads all of the transcripts from the trial that have occurred on that day. So right now, I'm looking at it right now, and I see the transcripts from June 18th, okay? And then it has all kinds of different commentary, documents. So it's a very comprehensive website. People can go to that if they want to sort of keep up on what's going on at the trial at The Hague. The other thing that I just wanted to also mention is that at the end of last year, Pathfinder Press, in commemoration of the 20th anniversary of Sankara's assassination, reissued Thomas Sankara Speaks, both in English and in French, and it is an enlarged version of that book, and it has sort of all of the speeches and all of the writings that Sankara did between 1983 and 1987, and it's a wonderful resource if people are interested in actually entering the mind of Thomas Sankara. It's just a really beautiful book, and you can access this at the Pathfinder website, which is www.pathfinderpress.com. That's www.pathfinderpress.com, and the title of the book is Thomas Sankara Speaks, the Burkina Faso Revolution, 1983 to 1987.
And I also want to mention that we do have a Pathfinder Press storefront kind of thing in Toronto, and they're located near Dundas West Station. And so, of course, if you go to the Pathfinder Press website for our listeners here in Toronto, you can find out the address of the storefront in Toronto. And Karina Ray, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Omi.
I'm really glad that we had the opportunity to do this interview.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Take care.
So those are some of the examples in terms of some of the things we were able to learn and hear about when we were when we had our radio station on CKLN 88.1. So I think one of the things that Amandla and I think Saturday Morning Live was able to bring to young people is the fact that you're hearing news from the continent. You're hearing news that you're not going to see on TV. You're hearing news that you're not going to hear on CBC Radio or anywhere else. And you're hearing it from the continent, from people, and from like the grassroots. So I think that was important. And that's the important thing I think we're trying to talk to people today about, taking back the radio station. It's not really about the airwaves. It's about the voices of the people who are listening and voices of what is happening to people. People are actually being represented.
And we need your support, all of you who are listening, and the struggle continue, a luta continue. Thank you very much.
And keep connecting to us, but take back our radio at blogspot.com. I'm not going to